Siri and I came down out of the hills and returned to the festival just before sunrise of the second day. For a night and a day we had roamed the hills, eaten with strangers in pavilions of orange silk, bathed together in the icy waters of the Shri, and danced to the music which never ceased going out to the endless file of passing isles. We were hungry. I had awakened at sunset to find Siri gone. She returned before the moon of Maui Covenant rose. She told me that her parents had gone off with friends for several days on a slow-moving houseboat. They had left the family skimmer in first sight. Now we worked our way from dance to dance, bonfire to bonfire, back to the center of the city. We planned to fly west to her family estate near Feverone. It was very late, but First Sight Common still had its share of revelers. I was very happy. I was 19, and I was in love, and the 0.93 gravity of Maui Covenant seemed much less to me. I could have flown, had I wished. I could have done anything. We had stopped at a booth and bought fried dough and mugs of black coffee. Suddenly a thought struck me. I asked, "How did you know I was a shipman?" "Hush, friend Merrin. Eat your poor breakfast. When we get to the villa, I will fix a true meal to break our fast." "No, I'm serious," I said, and wiped grease off my chin with the sleeve of my less-than-clean harlequin's costume. "This morning you said that you knew right away last night that I was from the ship. Why was that? Was it my accent? My costume? Mike and I saw other fellows dressed like this." Siri laughed and brushed back her hair. "Just be glad it was I who spied you out, Merrin, my love. Had it been my Uncle Gresham or his friends, it would have meant trouble." "Oh, why is that?" I picked up one more fried ring, and Siri paid for it. I followed her through the thinning crowd. Despite the motion and the music all about, I felt weariness beginning to work on me. "They are separatists," said Siri. "Uncle Gresham recently gave a speech before the council urging that we fight rather than agree to be swallowed into your hegemony. He said that we should destroy your Farcaster device before it destroys us." "Oh," I said. "Did he say how he was going to do that? The last I heard, you folks had no craft to get off-world in." "Nay, nor for the past 50 years have we," said Siri. "But it shows how irrational the Separatists can be." I nodded. Shipmaster Singh and Counselor Halman had briefed us on the so-called Separatists of Maui Covenant. "The usual coalition of colonial jingoists and throwbacks," Singh had said. "Another reason we go slow and develop the world's trade potential before finishing the Farcaster. The World Web doesn't need these yahoos coming in prematurely. And groups like the Separatists are another reason to keep you crew and construction workers the hell away from the groundlings." "Where is your skimmer?" I asked. The common was emptying quickly. Most of the bands had packed up their instruments for the night. Gaily costumed heaps lay snoring on the grass or cobblestones amid the litter and unlit lanterns. Only a few enclaves of merriment remained, groups dancing slowly to a lone guitar or singing drunkenly to themselves. I saw Mike Osho at once, a patchworked fool, his mask long gone, a girl on either arm. He was trying to teach the Hava Nagila to a rapt but inept circle of admirers. One of the troupe would stumble, and they would all fall down. Mike would flog them to their feet among general laughter, and they would start again, hopping clumsily to his basso profundo chant. "There it is," said Siri, and pointed to a short line of skimmers parked behind the common hall. I nodded and waved to Mike, but he was too busy hanging on to his two ladies to notice me. Siri and I had crossed the square and were in the shadows of the old building when the shout went up. "Shipman! Turn around, you hegemony son of a bitch!" I froze, and then wheeled around with fists clenched, but no one was near me. 6 young men had descended the steps from the grandstand and were standing in a semicircle behind Mike. The man in front was tall, slim, and strikingly handsome. He was 25 or 26 years old, and his long blonde curls spilled down on a crimson silk suit that emphasized his physique. In his right hand he carried a meter-long sword that looked to be of tempered steel. Mike turned slowly. Even from a distance I could see his eyes sobering as he surveyed the situation. The women at his side, and a couple of the young men in his group, tittered as if something humorous had been said. Mike allowed the inebriated grin to stay on his face.
"You address me, sir?" he asked.
"I address you, you hegemony whore's son," hissed the leader of the group. His handsome face was twisted into a sneer.
"Bertol," whispered Ciri, "my cousin, Gresham's younger son."
I nodded and stepped out of the shadows. Ciri caught my arm.
"That is twice you have referred unkindly to my mother, sir," slurred Mike. "Have she or I offended you in some way? If so, a thousand pardons."
Mike bowed so deeply that the bells on his cap almost brushed the ground. Members of his group applauded.
"Your presence offends me, you hegemony bastard! You stink up our air with your fat carcass!"
Mike's eyebrows rose comically. A young man near him in a fish costume waved his hand.
"Oh, come on, Bertol. He's just—" "Shut up, Ferrick! It is this fat shithead I am speaking to."
"Shithead?" repeated Mike, eyebrows still raised.
"I've traveled 200 light-years to be called a fat shithead. It hardly seems worth it."
He pivoted gracefully, untangling himself from the women as he did so. I would have joined Mike then, but Ciri clung tightly to my arm, whispering unheard entreaties. When I was free, I saw that Mike was still smiling, still playing the fool. But his left hand was in his baggy shirt pocket.
"Give him your blade, Craig," snapped Bertol.
One of the younger men tossed a sword, hilt first, to Mike. Mike watched it arc by and clang loudly on the cobblestones.
"You can't be serious," said Mike, in a soft voice that was suddenly quite sober. "You cretinous cow-turd! Do you really think I'm going to play duel with you, just because you get a hard-on acting the hero for these yokels?"
"Pick up the sword!" screamed Bertol, "or by God I'll carve you where you stand!"
He took a quick step forward. The youth's face contorted with fury as he advanced.
"Fuck off," said Mike.
In his left hand was the laser pen.
"No!" I yelled, and ran into the light.
That pen was used by construction workers to scrawl marks on girders of whiskered alloy.
Things happened very quickly then.
Bertol took another step, and Mike flicked the green beam across him almost casually. The colonist let out a cry and leaped back. A smoking line of black was slashed diagonally across his silk shirt front. I hesitated. Mike had the setting as low as it could go. Two of Bertol's friends started forward, and Mike swung the light across their shins. One dropped to his knees, cursing, and the other hopped away, holding his leg and hooting. A crowd had gathered. They laughed as Mike swept off his fool's cap in another bow.
"I thank you," said Mike. "My mother thanks you."
Ciri's cousin strained against his rage. Froths of spittle spilled on his lips and chin. I pushed through the crowd and stepped between Mike and the tall colonist.
"Hey, it's all right," I said. "We're leaving. We're going now."
"God damn it, Marin, get out of the way," said Mike.
"It's all right," I said as I turned to him. "I'm with a girl named Ciri who has a—"
Bertol stepped forward and lunged past me with his blade. I wrapped my left arm around his shoulder and flung him back. He tumbled heavily onto the grass.
"Oh, shit!"
said Mike as he backed up several paces. He looked tired and a little disgusted as he sat down on a stone step.
"Aw, damn," he said softly.
There was a short line of crimson in one of the black patches on the left side of his harlequin costume. As I watched, the narrow slit spilled over, and blood ran down across Mike Osho's broad belly.
"Oh, Jesus, Mike!"
I tore a strip of fabric from my shirt and tried to staunch the flow. I could remember none of the first aid we'd been taught as midshipmen. I pawed at my wrist, but my comlog was not there. We had left them on the Los Angeles. "It's not so bad, Mike," I gasped. "It's just a little cut." The blood flowed down over my hand and wrist.
"It will serve," said Mike.
His voice was held taut by a cord of pain.
"Damn! A fucking sword! Do you believe it, Marin? Cut down in the prime of my prime by a piece of fucking cutlery out of a fucking one-penny opera. Oh, damn, that smarts!"
"Three-penny opera," I said, and changed hands. The rag was soaked.
"You know what your fucking problem is, Marin? You're always sticking your fucking 2 cents in." "Oh!"
Mike's face went white and then gray. He lowered his chin to his chest and breathed deeply.
"To hell with this, kid. Let's go home, huh?"
I looked over my shoulder. Bertol was slowly moving away with his friends. The rest of the crowd milled around in shock.
"Call a doctor!" I screamed. "Get some medics up here!"
2 men ran down the street. There was no sign of Siri.
"Wait a minute! Wait a minute!"
said Mike in a stronger voice, as if he had forgotten something important.
"Just a minute," he said,
and died. Died. A real death. Brain death. His mouth opened obscenely, his eyes rolled back so only the whites showed, and a minute later the blood ceased pumping from the wound. For a few mad seconds I cursed the sky. I could see the L.A. moving across the fading starfield, and I knew that I could bring Mike back if I could get him there in a few minutes. The crowd backed away as I screamed and ranted at the stars. Eventually I turned to Bertol. "You," I said. The young man had stopped at the far end of the common. His face was ashen. He stared wordlessly. "You," I said again. I picked up the laser pen from where it had rolled, clicked the power to maximum, and walked to where Bertol and his friends stood waiting. Later, through the haze of screams and scorched flesh, I was dimly aware of Ceres' skimmer setting down in the crowded square, of dust flying up all around, and of her voice commanding me to join her. We lifted away from the light and madness. The cool wind blew my sweat-soaked hair away from my neck.
"We will go to Feveron," said Siri. "Bertol was drunk. The Separatists are a small, violent group. There will be no reprisals. You will stay with me until the Council holds the inquest."
"No," I said.
"There. Land there."
I pointed to a spit of land not far from the city. Siri landed, despite her protests. I glanced at the boulder to make sure the backpack was still there, and then climbed out of the skimmer. Siri slid across the seat and pulled my head down to hers.
"Marin, my love."
Her lips were warm and open, but I felt nothing. My body felt anesthetized. I stepped back and waved her away. She brushed her hair back and stared at me from green eyes filled with tears. Then the skimmer lifted, turned, and sped to the south in the early morning light.
"Just a minute!" I felt like calling.
I sat on a rock and gripped my knees as several ragged sobs were torn up out of me. Then I stood and threw the laser pen into the surf below. I tugged out the backpack and dumped the contents on the ground. The hawking mat was gone. I sat back down, too drained to laugh or cry or walk away. The sun rose as I sat there. I was still sitting there 3 hours later, when the large black skimmer from ship security set down silently beside me.
"Father? Father, it is getting late."
I turned to see my son, Donnell, standing behind me. He is wearing the blue and gold robe of the Hegemony Council. His bald scalp is flushed and beaded with sweat. Donnell is only 43, but he seems much older to me.
"Please, Father," he says.
I nod and rise, brushing off the grass and dirt. We walk together to the front of the tomb. The crowd has pressed closer now. Gravel crunches under their feet as they shift restlessly.
"Shall I enter with you, father?"
Donnell asks. I pause to look at this aging stranger who is my child. There is little of Ciri or me reflected in him. His face is friendly, florid, and tense with the excitement of the day. I can sense in him the open honesty which often takes the place of intelligence in some people. I cannot help but compare this balding puppy of a man to Alon. Alon of the dark curls and silences and sardonic smile. But Alon is 33 years dead, cut down in a stupid battle which had nothing to do with him. No, I say, I'll go in by myself. Thank you, Donnell. He nods and steps back. The pennants snap above the heads of the straining crowd. I turn my attention to the tomb. The entrance is sealed with a palm lock. I have only to touch it. During the past few minutes, I have developed a fantasy which will save me from both the growing sadness within and the external series of events which I have initiated. Ciri is not dead. In the last stages of her illness, she had called together the doctors and the few technicians left in the colony, and they rebuilt for her one of the ancient hibernation chambers used in their seed ship 2 centuries earlier. Ciri is only sleeping. What is more, the year-long sleep has somehow restored her youth. When I wake her, she will be the Ciri I remember from our early days. We will walk out into the sunlight together, and when the Farcaster doors open, we shall be the first through.
Father?
Yes. I step forward and set my hand to the door of the crypt. There is a whisper of electric motors, and the white slab of stone slides back. I bow my head and enter Ciri's tomb.
Damn it, Merrin! Secure that line before it knocks you overboard! Hurry!
I hurried. The wet rope was hard to coil, harder to tie off. Ciri shook her head in disgust and leaned over to tie a bowline knot with one hand. It was our 6th reunion. I had been 3 months too late for her birthday, but more than 5,000 other people had made it to the celebration. The CEO of the All Thing had wished her well in a 40-minute speech. A poet read his most recent verses to the Love Cycle sonnets. The hegemony ambassador had presented her with a scroll and a new ship, a small submersible powered by the first fusion cells to be allowed on Maui Covenant. Ciri had 18 other ships. 12 belonged to her fleet of swift catamarans that plied their trade between the wandering archipelago and the home islands. 2 were beautiful racing yachts that were used only twice a year to win the Founders' Regatta and the Covenant Criterium. The other 4 craft were ancient fishing boats, homely and awkward, well-maintained but little more than scows. Ciri had 19 ships, but we were on a fishing boat, the Ginny Paul. For the past 8 days we had fished the shelf of the equatorial shallows, a crew of 2, casting and pulling nets, wading knee-deep through stinking fish and crunching trilobites, wallowing over every wave, casting and pulling nets, keeping watch, and sleeping like exhausted children during our brief rest periods. I was not quite 23. I thought I was used to heavy labor aboard the L.A., and it was my custom to put in an hour of exercise in the 1.3G pod every 2nd shift. But now my arms and back ached from the strain, and my hands were blistered between the calluses. Ciri had just turned 70.
Merrin, go forward and reef the foresail. Do the same for the jib, and then go below to see to the sandwiches. Plenty of mustard.
I nodded and went forward. For a day and a half we'd been playing hide-and-seek with a storm, sailing before it when we could, turning about and accepting its punishment when we had to. At first it had been exciting, a welcome respite from the endless casting and pulling and mending. But after the first few hours the adrenaline rush faded, to be replaced by constant nausea, fatigue, and a terrible tiredness. The seas did not relent, The waves grew to 6 meters and higher. The Ginny Paul wallowed like the broad-beamed matron she was. Everything was wet. My skin was soaked under 3 layers of rain gear. For Siri, it was a long-awaited vacation. "This is nothing," she had said, during the darkest hour of the night, as waves washed over the deck and smashed against the scarred plastic of the cockpit. "You should see it during simoon season." The clouds still hung low and blended into gray waves in the distance, but the sea was down to a gentle 5-foot chop. I spread mustard across the roast beef sandwiches and poured steaming coffee into thick white mugs. It would have been easier to transport the coffee in 0G without spilling it than to get up the pitching shaft of the companionway. Siri accepted her depleted cup without commenting. We sat in silence for a bit, appreciating the food and the tongue-scalding warmth. I took the wheel when Siri went below to refill our mugs. The gray day was dimming almost imperceptibly into night. "Marin," she said after handing me my mug and taking a seat on the long, cushioned bench which encircled the cockpit, "what will happen after they open the Farcaster?" I was surprised by the question. We had almost never talked about the time when Maui Covenant would join the hegemony. I glanced over at Siri and was struck by how ancient she suddenly seemed. Her face was a mosaic of seams and shadows. Her beautiful green eyes had sunken into wells of darkness, and her cheekbones were knife edges against brittle parchment. She kept her gray hair cut short now, and it stuck out in damp spikes. Her neck and wrists were tendoned cords emerging from a shapeless sweater. "What do you mean?" I asked. "What will happen after they open the Farcaster?" "You know what the Council says, Siri." I spoke loudly because she was hard of hearing in one ear. "It will open a new era of trade and technology for Maui Covenant, and you won't be restricted to one little world any longer. When you become citizens, everyone will be entitled to use the Farcaster doors." "Yes," said Siri. Her voice was weary. "I have heard all of that, Marin. But what will happen? Who will be the first through to us?" I shrugged. "More diplomats, I suppose. Cultural contact specialists, anthropologists, ethnologists, marine biologists." "And then?" I paused. It was dark out. The sea was almost gentle. Our running lights glowed red and green against the night. I felt the same anxiety I had known 2 days earlier, when the wall of storm appeared on the horizon. I said, "And then will come the missionaries, the petroleum geologists, the sea farmers, the developers." Siri sipped at her coffee. "I would have thought your hegemony was far beyond a petroleum economy." I laughed and locked the wheel in. "Nobody gets beyond a petroleum economy, not while there's petroleum there. We don't burn it, if that's what you mean, but it's still essential for the production of plastics, synthetics, food base and keroids. 200 billion people use a lot of plastic." "And Maui Covenant has oil?" "Oh, yes," I said. There was no more laughter in me. "There are billions of barrels reservoired under the equatorial shallows alone."
"How will they get it, Marin? Platforms?"
"Yeah, platforms. Submersibles. Subsea colonies with tailored workers brought in from Mare Infinitus."
"And the Motal Isles?" asked Siri. "They must return each year to the shallows to feed on the blue kelp there and to reproduce. What will become of the isles?"
I shrugged again. I had drunk too much coffee, and it had left a bitter taste in my mouth. "I don't know," I said. "They haven't told the crew much. But back on our first trip out, Mike heard that they plan to develop as many of the isles as they can, so some will be protected."
"Develop?"
Siri's voice showed surprise for the first time.
"How can they develop the isles?
Even the first families must ask permission of the sea folk to build our treehouse retreats there." I smiled at Siri's use of the local term for the dolphins. The Maui Covenant colonists were such children when it came to their damned dolphins. The plans are all set, I said. There are 128,573 Motal Isles big enough to build a dwelling on. Leases to those have long since been sold. The smaller isles will be broken up, I suppose. The home islands will be developed for recreation purposes.
Recreation purposes? Echoed Siri. How many people from the hegemony will use the Farcaster to come here, for recreation purposes?
At first, you mean? I asked. Just a few thousand the first year, as long as the only door is on Island 241. The trade center, it will be limited. Perhaps 50,000 the second year, when First Sight gets its door? It'll be quite the luxury tour. Always is after a seed colony is first opened to the web.
And later?
After the 5-year probation. There will be thousands of doors, of course. I would imagine there will be 20 or 30 million new residents coming through during the first year of full citizenship.
20 or 30 million, said Siri.
The light from the compass stand illuminated her lined face from below. There was still a beauty there. But there was no anger or shock. I had expected both. But you'll be citizens then yourself, I said, free to step anywhere in the world web. There will be 16 new worlds to choose from, probably more by then.
Yes, said Siri, and set aside her empty mug. A fine rain streaked the glass around us. The crude radar screen set in its hand-carved frame showed the seas empty. The storm passed.
Is it true, Marin, that people in the hegemony have their homes on 12 worlds? One house, I mean, with windows facing out on 12 skies?
Sure, I said, but not many people. Only the rich can afford multi-world residences like that.
Siri smiled and set her hand on my knee. The back of her hand was mottled and blue-veined.
But you are very rich, are you not, shipman?
I looked away. Not yet, I'm not.
Ah, but soon, Marin, soon. How long for you, my love?
Less than 2 weeks here, and then the voyage back to your hegemony. 5 months more of your time to bring the last components back, a few weeks to finish, and then you step home, a rich man.
Step 200 empty light-years home. What a strange thought. But where was I? That is, how long? Less than a standard year.
10 months, I said. 306 standard days. 314 of yours. 918 shifts.
And then your exile will be over.
Yes.
And you will be 24 years old and very rich.
Yes.
I'm tired, Marin. I want to sleep now.
We programmed the tiller, set the collision alarm, and went below. The wind had risen some, and the old vessel wallowed from wave crest to trough with every swell. We undressed in the dim light of the swinging lamp. I was first in the bunk and under the covers. It was the first time Siri and I had shared a sleep period. Remembering our last reunion and her shyness at the villa, I expected her to douse the light. Instead, she stood a minute, nude in the chill air, thin arms calmly at her sides. Time had claimed Siri, but had not ravaged her.
Gravity had done its inevitable work on her breasts and buttocks, and she was much thinner. I stared at the gaunt outlines of ribs and breastbone, and remembered the 16-year-old girl with baby fat and skin like warm velvet.
In the cold light of the swinging lamp, I stared at Siri's sagging flesh, and remembered moonlight on budding breasts. Yet somehow, strangely, inexplicably, it was the same Siri who stood before me now.
Move over, Marin.
She slipped into the bunk beside me. The sheets were cool against our skin, the rough blanket welcome. I turned off the light. The little ship swayed to the regular rhythm of the sea's breathing. I could hear the sympathetic creak of masts and rigging. In the morning we would be casting and pulling and mending. But now there was time to sleep. I began to doze to the sound of waves against wood.
Merrin?
Yes.
What would happen if the Separatists attacked the hegemony tourists or the new residents?
I thought the Separatists had all been carted off to the Isles.
They have been, but what if they resisted?
The hegemony would send in force troops who could kick the shit out of the Separatists.
What if the Farcaster itself were attacked, destroyed before it was operational?
Impossible.
Yes, I know, but what if it were?
Then the Los Angeles would return 9 months later, with hegemony troops who would proceed to kick the shit out of the Separatists, and anyone else on Maui Covenant who got in their way.
9 months ship time, said Siri. 11 years of our time.
But inevitable either way, I said. Let's talk about something else.
All right, said Siri.
But we did not speak. I listened to the creak and sigh of the ship. Siri had nestled into the hollow of my arm. Her head was on my shoulder, and her breathing was so deep and regular that I thought her to be asleep. I was almost asleep myself, when her warm hand slid up my leg and lightly cupped me. I was startled, even as I began to stir and stiffen. Siri whispered an answer to my unasked question.
No, Merrin, one is never really too old. At least not too old to want the warmth and closeness. You decide, my love. I will be content either way.
I decided. Toward the dawn, we slept. The tomb is empty. Donnell, come in here. He bustles in, robes rustling in the hollow emptiness. The tomb is empty. There is no hibernation chamber. I did not truly expect there to be one. But neither is there sarcophagus or coffin. A bright bulb illuminates the white interior. What the hell is this, Donnell? I thought this was Ciri's tomb.
It is, Father.
Where is she interred? Under the floor, for Christ's sake? Donnell mops at his brow. I remember that it is his mother I am speaking of. I also remember that he has had almost 2 years to accustom himself to the idea of her death.
No one told you? He asks.
Told me what? The anger and confusion are already ebbing. I was rushed here from the dropship station and told that I was to visit Ciri's tomb before the Farcaster opening. What?
Mother was cremated as per her instructions. Her ashes were spread on the Great South Sea from the highest platform of the family isle.
Then why this crypt? I watch what I say. Donnell is sensitive. He mops his brow again and glances to the door. We are shielded from the view of the crowd, but we are far behind schedule. Already the other members of the council have had to hurry down the hill to join the dignitaries on the bandstand. My slow grief this day has been worse than bad timing. It has turned into bad theater.
Mother left instructions. They were carried out.
He touches a panel on the inner wall, and it slides up to reveal a small niche containing a metal box. My name is on it. What is that? Donnell shakes his head.
Personal items Mother left for you. Only Magritte knew the details, and she died last winter without telling anyone.
All right, I said. Thank you. I'll be out in a moment. Donnell glances at his chronometer.
The ceremony begins in 8 minutes. They will activate the Farcaster in 20 minutes.
I know, I say. I do know. Part of me knows precisely how much time is left. I'll be out in a moment. Donnell hesitates and then departs. I close the door behind him with a touch of my palm. The metal box is surprisingly heavy. I set it on the stone floor and crouch beside it. A smaller palm lock gives me access. The lid clicks open, and I peer into the container.
Well, I'll be damned, I say softly.
I do not know what I expected. Artifacts, perhaps? Nostalgic mementos of our 103 days together. perhaps a pressed flower from some forgotten offering, or the French horn conch we dove for off Feveron. But there are no mementos, not as such. The box holds a small Steiner gin hand laser, one of the most powerful projection weapons ever made. The accumulator is attached by a power lead to a small fusion cell that Ciri must have cannibalized from her new submersible. Also attached to the fusion cell is an ancient comm log, an antique with a solid-state interior and a liquid crystal disk key. The charge indicator glows green. There are two other objects in the box. One is the translator medallion we had used so long ago. The final object makes me literally gape in surprise. "Why, you little bitch," I say. Things fall into place. I cannot stop a smile. "You dear, conniving little bitch." There, rolled carefully, power lead correctly attached, lies the hawking mat Mike Osho bought in Carvnell Marketplace for 30 marks. I leave the hawking mat there, disconnect the comm log, and lift it out. I sit cross-legged on the cold stone and thumb the disky. The light in the crypt fades out, and suddenly Ciri is there before me. They did not throw me off the ship when Mike died. They could have, but they did not. They did not leave me to the mercy of provincial justice on Maui Covenant. They could have, but they chose not to. For 2 days I was held in security and questioned, once by Shipmaster Singh himself. Then they let me return to duty. For the 4 months of the long leap back, I tortured myself with the memory of Mike's murder. I knew that in my clumsy way I had helped to murder him. I put in my shifts, dreamed my sweaty nightmares, and wondered if they would dismiss me when we reached the web. They could have told me, but they chose not to. They did not dismiss me. I was to have my normal leave in the web, but could take no off-ship R&R while in the Maui Covenant system. In addition, there was a written reprimand and temporary reduction in rank. That was what Mike's life had been worth, a reprimand and reduction in rank. I took my 3-week leave with the rest of the crew, but, unlike the others, I did not plan to return. I farcast to Esperance and made the classic shipman's mistake of trying to visit family. 2 days in the crowded residential bulb was enough, and I stepped to Lussus and took my pleasure in 3 days of whoring on the Rue des Chats. When my mood turned darker, I cast to Fuji and lost most of my ready marks betting on the bloody samurai fights there. Finally, I found myself farcasting to Home System Station and taking the 2-day pilgrim shuttle down to Hellas Basin. I had never been to Home System or Mars before, and I never planned to return, but the 10 days I spent there, alone and wandering the dusty, haunted corridors of the monastery, served to send me back to the ship, back to Ciri. Occasionally I would leave the red-stoned maze of the megalith and, clad only in skin-suit and mask, stand on one of the uncounted thousands of stone balconies and stare skyward at the pale gray star which had once been old Earth. Sometimes then I thought of the brave and stupid idealists heading out into the great dark in their slow and leaking ships, carrying embryos and ideologies with equal faith and care. But most times I did not try to think. Most times I simply stood in the purple night and let Ciri come to me. There, in the Master's Rock, where perfect Satori had eluded so many much worthier pilgrims, I achieved it through the memory of a not-quite-16-year-old woman-child's body, lying next to mine while moonlight spilled from a Thomas Hawk's wings. When the Los Angeles spun back up to a quantum state, I went with her. 4 months later, I was content to pull my shift with the construction crew, plug into my usual stims, and sleep my R&R away. Then Singh came to me. "You're going down," he said. I did not understand.
In the past 11 years, the groundlings have turned your screw-up with Osho into a goddamned legend, said Singh. There's an entire cultural mythos built around your little role in the hay with that colonial girl.
Siri, I said.
Get your gear, said Singh. You'll spend your 3 weeks groundside. The ambassador's experts say you'll do the hegemony more good down there than up here. We'll see.
The world was waiting. Crowds were cheering. Siri was waving.
We left the harbor in a yellow catamaran and sailed south-southeast, bound for the archipelago and her family isle.
Hello, Marin.
Siri floats in the darkness of her tomb. The hollow is not perfect. A haziness mars the edges. But it is Siri. Siri, as I last saw her. Gray hair shorn rather than cut. Head high, face sharpened with shadows.
Hello, Marin, my love.
Hello, Siri, I say. The tomb door is closed.
I am sorry I cannot share our 7th reunion, Marin. I looked forward to it.
Siri pauses and looks down at her hands. The image flickers slightly as dust motes float through her form.
I had carefully planned what to say here, she goes on. How to say it. Arguments to be pled, instructions to be given. But I know now how useless that would have been. Either I have said it already, and you have heard, or there is nothing left to say, and silence would best suit the moment.
Siri's voice had grown even more beautiful with age. There is a fullness and calmness there which can only come from knowing pain. Siri moves her hands, and they disappear beyond the border of the projection.
Marin, my love, how strange our days apart and together have been. How beautifully absurd the myth that bound us. My days were but heartbeats to you. I hated you for that. You were the mirror that would not lie. If you could have seen your face at the beginning of each reunion, the least you could have done was to hide your shock. That, at least, you could have done for me. But through your clumsy naivete there has always been—
What?
Something, Marin. There is something there that belies the callowness and thoughtless egotism which you wear so well. A caring, perhaps. A respect for caring, if nothing else. Marin, this diary has hundreds of entries. Thousands, I fear. I have kept it since I was 13. By the time you see this, they will all have been erased, except the ones which follow. Adieu, my love. Adieu.
I shut off the comm log and sit in silence for a minute. The crowd sounds are barely audible through the thick walls of the tomb. I take a breath and thumb the disk key. Siri appears. She is in her late 40s. I know immediately the day and place she recorded this image. I remember the cloak she wears, the eelstone pendant at her neck, and the strand of hair which has escaped her beret and even now falls across her cheek. I remember everything about that day. It was the last day of our 3rd reunion, and we were with friends on the heights above South Turn. Donnell was 10, and we were trying to convince him to slide on the snowfield with us. He was crying. Siri turned away from us even before the skimmer settled. When Magritte stepped out, we knew from Siri's face that something had happened. The same face stares at me now. She brushes absently at the unruly strand of hair. Her eyes are red, but her voice is controlled.
Marin, they killed our son today. Alon was 21, and they killed him.
You were so confused today, Marin.
How could such a mistake have happened, you kept repeating. You did not really know our son, but I could see the loss in your face when we heard.
Marin, it was not an accident. If nothing else survives, no other record, if you never understand why I allowed a sentimental myth to rule my life, let this be known. It was not an accident that killed Alon. He was with the Separatists when the Council police arrived. Even then he could have escaped. We had prepared an alibi together. The police would have believed his story. He chose to stay.
Today, Marin, you were impressed with what I said to the crowd. The mob. At the embassy. Know this, shipman. When I said, now is not the time to show your anger and your hatred, that is precisely what I meant. No more, no less. Today is not the time. But the day will come. It will surely come. The covenant was not taken lightly in those final days, Marin. It is not taken lightly now.
Those who have forgotten will be surprised when the day comes, but it will surely come. The image fades to another, and in the split second of overlap, the face of a 26-year-old Ciri appears, superimposed on the older woman's features.
Marin, I am pregnant. I'm so glad. You've been gone 5 weeks now, and I miss you. 10 years you'll be gone. More than that. Marin, why didn't you think to invite me to go with you? I could not have gone, but I would have loved it if you had just invited me. But I'm pregnant, Marin. The doctors say that it will be a boy. I will tell him about you, my love.
Perhaps some day you and he will sail in the archipelago and listen to the songs of the sea folk, as you and I have done these past few weeks. Perhaps you'll understand them by then.
Marin, I miss you. Please hurry back.
The holographic image shimmers and shifts. The 16-year-old girl is red-faced. Her long hair cascades over bare shoulders and a white nightgown. She speaks in a rush, racing tears.
Shipman Marin Aspic, I'm sorry about your friend. I really am. But you left without even saying goodbye. I had such plans about how you would help us. How you and I... You didn't even say goodbye. I don't care what happens to you. I hope you go back to your stinking, crowded hegemony hives and rot for all I care. In fact, Marin Aspic, I wouldn't want to see you again, even if they paid me. Goodbye!
She turns her back before the projection fades. It is dark in the tomb now, but the audio continues for a second. There is a soft chuckle and Ciri's voice. I cannot tell the age. Comes one last time. Adieu, Marin. Adieu. Adieu, I say, and thumb the disk key off.